Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 48. I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'll be your host today. And today we're talking about heritage, tourism, and race. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nootch or Ute People's Treaty Lands, the Dineta, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. So today we have Dr. Antoinette Jackson back on the show. Dr. Jackson is a professor and chair of the Department of Anthropology at the University of South Florida and the director of the USF Heritage Research Lab. She received her PhD in anthropology from the University of Florida, her MBA from Xavier University, and a BA in computer and information science from the Ohio State University, where she was also an All-American 100-meter hurdler. From 2012 to 2016, she served as the National Park Service Regional Cultural Anthropologist for the Southeast region. So on today's episode, we're going to be talking about Dr. Jackson's new book, which is Heritage, Tourism, and Race, The Other Side of Leisure. She sent it to me a few months ago, and I really enjoyed reading it. I'm sure that you guys will also enjoy hearing about it and hopefully reading it. I definitely recommend reading it and then coming back and listening to this episode afterwards. So Heritage, Tourism, and Race, The Other Side of Leisure is about heritage and leisure tourism in the Americas, seen through the lens of race. It is especially concerned with redressing gaps in recognizing and critically accounting for African Americans as an underrepresented community in leisure. There is a diversity of African American leisure experiences, and the book exposes the refusal of African Americans to surrender inalienable rights and a determination to pursue leisure, often outside the purview of white power and control. It attempts to complicate notions of travel, leisure, and tourism with respect to race. And we'll get into this later in the episode, but basically, if you've ever had that question, why are there so few minorities in national parks, you know, whatever tourism site you're referring to, this is going to be the episode for you. So welcome to the show, Dr. Jackson.
Oh, thank you. So good to be back with you.
Yes, I'm so excited to talk about your book. Yeah, I really loved reading this book. First of all, it was very exciting when you emailed me and said you were going to send me a free copy of your book. I feel like there's nothing that makes you feel like you've made it more than like getting a free book. Maybe that's just an anthropology, but I was like, ooh, I've made it.
I think that's for all of us social scientists.
Yes. But yeah, no, I really loved this book. It was funny. I mentioned in my email back to you that, you know, I was kind of surprised when I first saw your book about the topic. And, you know, I was like, leisure, that's kind of an interesting thing to be writing about. And then, you know, I was reading the book and it just all made so much sense to me. And I felt kind of stupid for having wondered about the topic of the book. Felt a little silly that I didn't like immediately understand what you were going for there until I opened it up and was like, oh, yeah, absolutely. But yeah, I just, sorry, not maybe where you were expecting me to go at first.
Not really, but I think it's honest, at least. I mean, definitely, yeah. I think people may have a lighter interpretation when they see The Other Side of Leisure and like, you know, mm-hmm. What is that about? So I think it does catch people by surprise that really the critical thinking within that notion of leisure, which is partly why I think it's provocative in that sense, because it does catch people off guard with something they think is benign. And then they are, oh, no, it's not so benign.
Well, I think I almost had like the opposite reaction in a sense where it was like, which I mean is also problematic, where I was kind of like, oh, leisure, like you're talking about leisure during like segregation and slavery, like, you know, that is, doesn't that seem like frivolous, quote unquote, when compared to like these big heavy topics? But it's like, it's the exact same thing. Again, it's like, we also don't only want to be defined by moments put on us by our oppressors in the past. You know what I mean? Like, so it was one of those like, oh God, like this stuff, it's so culturally ingrained deep that even like when you can relate, you still like miss it. So yeah.
Yeah.
There wasn't really a question and, I guess.
Within leisure, I guess, but I'll pick it up anyways. But leisure does expose a lot of activities and things that go on within that context, and within that sphere that people really, again, I think don't, you know, they don't critique in that way because it's leisure, and but lots of things go on in that capacity, and to ignore it, as you highlighted, even for different reasons, and you miss a lot of critical things about a cultural group or a cultural group's resilience in the face of oftentimes marginalization. So this is a defense against that.
Right. Okay. Can you talk a little bit more about that concept of like how it's a defense against marginalization, leisure?
Yeah. I mean, but because leisure is a topic that most people can, you know, somehow conjure up some kind of imagery around or some kind of activity that they would associate with that. But the very act of being able to be culturally engaged in something, activity of leisure, as you say, shows a humanity that is afforded to people who can do leisure. And so this is a defense against marginalization in the sense that if you show yours, if you reflect on that aspect of a group's participation, being able to participate in leisure and do those kinds of things, you highlight humanity in an area that people may think it's marginal or not so threatening. And so, but in that light, you do see the humanity of people in a broader perspective. So it puts people back in conversation in a different kind of way, like you said, because many marginalized groups are seen in the thing that's marginalizing, the thing that they have been, that's taken away from them, which is, you know, maybe their access to food or access to freedom. And you focus on their tensions around that as opposed to the other things that they themselves culturally define themselves as being. And within leisure, foodways and civic activities and being with family and music and art, those are the kinds of ways a people, a person, gets to express who they are. And for us to see them in their own expression of themselves, even when the gaze is not on them, what is happening? That's even the beauty of it. Because in the book, I look at spaces where that have been ignored, where people were doing leisure and what were they doing? And then you do see people in their own capacity to express themselves. What are they expressing? And that, I think, comes out a lot in the book. When people are expressing themselves in the place, in the ways and spaces that are available to them and that they feel comfortable, what is it that we see about that people? Even in the middle of harsh conditions of maybe a plantation space or segregated space, there's still people are expressing a humanity in the act of leisure that we may not pay attention to or we may not give light to. And I try to do so in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I think you give a lot of different examples in the book of what that looks like. Could you just give a few examples of how people created their own leisure experience in the face of that exclusion and like how it came more from who they were? And but like this concept that like that you talk about in the book that you discredit of basically like, oh, if people just like knew enough about these types of leisures that they would seek it. But basically you're saying that people have their own ways of seeking leisure. That's not just like imitating, you know, the white forms of leisure and things like that. That was probably more than one question.
I think, I think a lot of questions in there, but I think I think leisure, because of the expression of having the freedom to rest or to express without being dictated by a certain person or group or entity to express your humanity in the way that is most appropriate to you and with the people you're with. I think that credit is not given to people who are considered or have been considered second class citizens in the context of Western ideas of, you know, the of white supremacy, with whiteness being the thing that defines everything. But within that, there is no credit given to people who, you know, are existing as humans with their own standards and their own ways of expressing. So in my book, I talk about, you know, if I give an example, like in Tampa here, there's a community called Sulphur Springs. And I'm looking at the fact that Sulphur Springs was known as it created at one point in the 1920s and 30s, it was created a space that was Sulphur Springs, that people came from the north and all over to enjoy leisure activities. And they had a water park and a swimming pool and the swimming hole, all in the arcade and all kinds of like formal kind of things that you would associate with leisure activities. The thing about that, and movie theaters and all those kinds of things, but the thing about that, it excluded Black people and people who were not considered white at the time. But in parallel to that, Black folk were doing those things that, although we talk about Sulphur Springs as being the place where people came for leisure and to leisure, people were leisuring instead of only catering to white folk when they were working in these sites of leisure in Sulphur Springs. They were also having fellowship and leisure within their church. So there were church socials. Black folk were built their own golf course in some place. In one part of the community, they had use the church grounds for roller skating and church basements for movie theaters and all the, you know, and fellowship and dance halls and all those kinds of things. Activities were going on in this case within the infrastructure of churches. Mm-hmm. Because they had land a lot of times and they had authority over their space, they were able to be gathering spaces for all kinds of things, as we know from the civil rights movement, from political conversations to, you know, actual leisure activities. And the thing is, all of those things were often combined in these spaces. So people were leisuring, having celebrations and picnics and family reunions and swimming and maybe in the river as opposed to in the designated swimming pool, but gathering and enjoying company with people that they felt safe with. This was happening. And then people look forward to that and they did that. But that was not the focus. When somebody said, let's talk about leisure, they never go and say, let's talk about what leisure was happening or what leisure looked like in different settings. And that's what I not only talk about what happened in the formal and recognized space that people know of, Sulphur Springs, where they actually had the designated pool and movie theaters. I also talk about other spaces where leisure was going on. Again, a lot of church places or other places throughout the community. But these were active spaces for Black folk to share in leisure with one another. So it's just that they don't get that kind of emphasis. So people think they're not doing it.
Yeah, you gave a lot of different examples, you know, just from making ice cream at home, fishing, eating berries. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like beaches, all different kinds of examples. I don't want to like do exactly what we were just talking about and just focus on, you know, like what's been put on a community. But I did have a pretty strong reaction to like reading the church section, just thinking in terms of like the, you know, Birmingham church bombing and the Emmanuel mm-hmm. African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston mm-hmm. in 2015. And like that chapter really put in context for me, like, you know, that if a church is your safe space and your place
mm-hmm. yes.
where you go to have fun, like how, you know, truly terrorizing Not that like I didn't know that they were, but like on another level, you know what I mean, that those events for. But I mean, again, we don't need to focus on what was, you know, we want to have this conversation about, you know, the resilience of people, not necessarily just the white supremacy aspect of it, which is well talked about. But I think you bring out a good point. Yeah. I mean, it was a little like I read that section. I was like, oh, that is even more devastating than I realized. Mm-hmm. One thing I like about this book, too, is so you're talking about, you're looking at leisure from like multiple different perspectives, you know, so you're looking at like, first of all, how people, you know, like found their own way to make it happen and really like, you know, the resilience and all of that aspect, but also not ignoring the fact that a lot of the recreation places that people go to today are there because of, you know, slavery, or at least they're still benefiting from that experience. Like, what was the cave, Mammoth Cave in Kentucky,
the Mammoth Cave. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so I thought that that was like an important way of showing both sides of the same thing, I guess, which is also not a question.
Yes, I was waiting either for a question or you want me to comment.
Yeah. So I guess what's, you know, like looking at that and the churches, for example, how do you balance those two narratives, I guess? Because like, obviously you don't want to ignore the reality of what happened, but you also don't want to take the focus away from, you know, these communities and their ingenuity and resilience and put it just on, you know, white actions. So I guess like, how do you balance that with this book and in your work?
Yeah, I think that's the tension of the entire book. The argument that's basically set up in the book is that balance. Like, how do you tell the story of people's experience with tourism, travel, leisure, and, you know, tell it from their own context, from their own perspective? In this case, I'm focusing on from an African-American or Black community perspective in terms of how they approach those things of tourism, leisure, in the context of race, but also talk about the bigger structures that were in place that created barriers for people. And so to interrogate the creation of the barriers or the institutional barriers, and also give privilege to those things that people were doing that are given little focus. So I think it's part educational, looking at the systemic racism, beginning with slavery and into segregation, and also looking at the humanity of people and how people express their humanity through leisure. So it is as often it's throughout the book is that tension. And, you know, in the case of Mammoth Cave, for example, that you brought up, was just one of the national parks and a World Heritage Site. When you think about a place like Mammoth Cave and caving in general, again, this kind of really crystallizes that tension. Because what comes to mind, who comes to mind when you think about caving as a leisure activity, caving as a place that people go to visit a national park and embark on caving? What conceptually comes to your mind? Like, what stories and what pictures do you think about? And then that does not often include either the histories of Native communities around those cave sites or the history of African-American or Black communities in relation to that discussion. That seems like far-fetched. Caving and those, you know, when you start associating with those histories and those peoples. And if you go back and look at the story, I trace it back historically and then into the present. How do we come to exclude that in the conversation about caving? How do we come to really be surprised when you suddenly mention Black people in caving? Like, why is that an anomaly of some sort? And when they were integral into the conversation about the development of that cave site or caving tourism in that park area, period. So how do we go about disassociating entire communities from something that was kind of really part of their historical trajectory for communities in that area. So that's an interesting conversation. And that's part of the white premise. So that's the part of our education around, you know, what is the national story and who's considered the face of that. And so I interrogate that again, and then also show the history of a Black family around caving in and of itself. Like, what were people doing from their family perspective around caving in these Black families that had to do with caving? So I look at both sides, both aspects in the discussion, so that to bring people into that same kind of attention and have them ask those same kind of questions that I was curious about when I wrote particularly that chapter.
Okay, we're already at the end of our first segment, but before we go, there's one thing I wanted to throw in there, which was, you know, one thing that I had meant to bring up at the beginning of this episode and didn't and already slipped up on it, was I wanted to highlight something from our last conversation, which was talking about the difference between the word slaves and enslaved people. And I just did it. It's ingrained pretty deep, but I do think that the distinction is very important. And so I just wanted to make a note of that before we move on to the next section. But I'd love to continue to talk a little bit more in the next section about Mammoth Cave, because I think it's a really interesting example in your book. And then also get to the question that I was originally going to start this interview with. And then we got kind of on a tangent from the very beginning. So we will be right back here in a second.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code HEVO, HEVO.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, we're back from our break where we talked about skiing adventures along the theme of leisure. And we are going to dive back into our conversation about Mammoth Cave. So I remember when I was reading the book, one of the stories that you mentioned in there, or not so much story, but just I think it might have even been something that was kind of more in passing, but it really stuck with me, was about, let me make sure I have his name. So Stephen Bishop, and that he was enslaved and he drew a map of Mammoth Cave from memory based on, you know, all of his caving experience, and that this map is still sold today in the visitor center. So this enslaved person's map that obviously like they got no benefit from, the Park Service is still literally selling and making money off of. I don't know. I mean, that moment, just like I remember reading it, and that one really, really stuck with me. And then obviously the family as well. So yeah, could you talk a little bit more about the Mammoth Cave chapter?
Yeah, the Mammoth Cave chapter, I always think about my book, and every time somebody asks me a different chapter is generally my favorite or something that stands out, but consistently it is the Mammoth Cave chapter that I always go back to because it's chock full of so many different tropes and so many different tensions. And the biggest one is the one you just outlined about the enslaved Africans and their relationship to Mammoth Cave in terms of being working in the saltpeter mines and then their relationship to being cave guides for the National Park Service and in many cases mapping or creating a mapping that's still used to find some of the major sites within these caves. And Stephen Bishop is one of those maps, right, that's sold at the Park Service and at the site when you go to that Mammoth Cave. And it's placed in a positive context when you think about it at the park, you know, because the story is couched again, this is a formerly enslaved person creates this map and it's very useful and the park uses it to highlight, you know, or give kind of credit to the fact that that's possible or that's there or that's part of their history. But what I find problematic, in addition to what you're stating about the selling of the map, is the fact that it's sort of positioned now as an exception. That again, for me, Black people were part of the history of Mammoth Cave from its inception as a national park and beyond, and before, way before. And the fact that we have to kind of place them into the story of the park in a different kind of way, as opposed to them being historically part of, and even could have had a legacy of Black cave guides that can still be, who would still be active in the park, or that could have been still a trajectory of the park's history. But the park, you know, the National Park Service fired all the Black cave guides, the people who created maps like that, or who were intricately knowledgeable of the caves, and those folks were fired for a National Park Service and then replaced by National Park Service personnel. And so that to me breaks the continuity. One of the ways that the continuity, the history of Black people and their relationship with the park was broken, and it had to be reimagined or repositioned into what we learn about the park. And I think that part, that breakage, is a problematic because, again, it shows that the system that was in place excluded Black people as being able to be cave guides in the national park system of hierarchy and also in the system of segregation. They were buying into the system of segregation and other protocols. I don't know why they would fire the Black cave guides other than the obvious. But the fact is, you break a chain of history, and then you have to represented in one way that's done is a gift shop selling of a map, as opposed to having being able to tell a story of a history and heritage of people who are associated with that park. You tell it in a different way because you kicked those folk out through eminent domain. A lot of the lands that were Black people's lands were taken away to create the national park, and all these kinds of things that disrupted the history of what was Mammoth Cave. And then we get this, you know, this reconstituted kind of history in which you add Black people back in to the story.
Right.
So the power dynamics totally shifted, and it shifts the story, but we don't hear it that way. And then the notion of then, back to a question of then, why aren't Black people involved with the park? But they had already been, like, historically, they were integral to Mammoth Cave. All kinds of ways, but now fast forward to now, it's like, you know, that's the more of the exception, which is what I kind of bring out in the book. Why is that an exceptional story when it was the main story?
Right.
The park. And so getting at the tension of that is part of what I talk about in the book, and then showcasing even more Black families, the Branson family's history, you know, continuous generational history with that park, with Mammoth Cave, and how to see the park through that lens as well.
Yeah, that was, I love this chapter because it feels like it's got so many of the different elements that you're talking about all in one chapter. You know, like, for example, you talk about, the Bransford family and that they led African-American specific tours so that even with segregation, African-American people could still visit the park. And they built a hotel for those visitors. And then just like, you know, all those jobs were lost when the Park Service took over, they also lost their hotel because of eminent domain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. They lost their lands, their homes. Yeah, their homes and all of those kinds of things because of eminent domain. So all of the places surrounding the park as well as the things that were actually physically contained within the park.
Yeah. And then interestingly, and I'm their great-great-grandson became a guide in 2004, kind of bringing that legacy back. Yeah, so that whole, it was just a really interesting story of that family.
Yeah. Yeah, to bring it, that's what I was saying, to bring that legacy back. Everything has to be added. Like if you start from the present, they're adding these stories and connections back that were, you know, historically part of that, and the whole unfolding of that park. So we lose that and then we have to get it back. And it's then re-narrated through the Park Service's kind of interpretive of lens.
Right.
And the other thing, one other thing that it shows is that the whole tension around do Black people do things outdoors, or what is the relationship back Black people to outdoor activities and all those things and all the theories around like Black people in the outdoors. Caving is one of those areas too that disrupts that narrative, because again, Black folk were caving, they were doing things outside and all those kinds of things in that chapter. You see it's a kind of critique of this outdoor, this dismissal or erasure of Black people in their relationship to the outdoors.
Right. I always think that's an interesting discussion and where we were going to start this interview and got just, you know, sidetracked on all these other interesting conversations and what I'd like to bring it back to. About, you know, there's always these conversations about the underrepresentation of groups of different communities in, you know, the Park Service and other tourism leisure sites. You know, it's always like, well, how can we get, you know, Black people interested in going to the national parks? And that's something that you discuss right at the very beginning of this book. Can you, and obviously like shaped why you wrote this book, can you talk a little bit about your response to that conversation?
Yeah, and you're right. That question, actually that crystal central question is, why aren't Black people visiting national parks, or what can we do to, you know, increase the diversity of the parks, which is a conversation that every institution everywhere is having. But I was particularly intrigued by this conversation with the national parks, especially after my experiences with all the various parks that I work with, particularly in the Southeast region and in those histories. And, you know, I found it frustrating because of the question seems to put the problem on the very people that aren't at the parks. And then I was like, what is the history of exclusion? What is the history of marginalization at those parks? Many of those places actively put in place processes whereby Black folk and other folk were not included. They particularly made it so that they were not invited or felt uncomfortable or totally told not to come. So unless we are going to address that history in the same, and that process, those processes in the same conversation, then I think you are starting out with the wrong question. And then it was also intriguing to me that even though they're asking these questions of why aren't Black people at the park, the thing that they don't interrogate is what I just mentioned, but people come up with elaborate theories to me that seem, especially in the context of leisure and why Black people aren't participating in certain kind of leisure activities, which include going to national parks. And they have like the marginalization theory that Black people aren't, you know, they either don't have the resources in terms of monetary resources or access ways to get to these places or knowledge about them. Like that is something that is proposed as a theoretical reason why they may not be at these parks, or that they have their own cultural norms and that excludes like their cultural norms and practices around leisure and outdoor activities exclude parks in some capacity. So something about their culture is the reason that they don't do that. Or eventually, as you move up on the food chain, you will assimilate into this idea of doing more things that are considered things that white people do, which is going to the parks. So the assimilation kind of theory is that eventually people will rise to the occasion and be able to get to these parks or want to do those kinds of activities. And the discrimination theory kind of is like, oh, discrimination happened when people visited a park, and it's sort of like something, this X factor happened, and we don't need to examine that. But the idea that people were discriminated against may be, you know, variable. It's not interrogating, which I added a fourth thing in the book, and you'll see the main theory that I posit is exclusion, active exclusion. We need to talk about how these folk were actively excluded from these very parks and places, and that you are saying that they're not at. Let's start there. And so I you know, ask any agency in any place, what are the things that you have been doing that you have processes and things you have in place that actively make sure that these were the people that weren't going to come through those doors in the first place?
Right, right.
So until you ask those questions of yourself and look at your organization and your history, then you're going to keep missing the mark of what really needs to be done. And so that's what I ask in the book in each of these places.
Well, I'm just curious if you could give some examples of, I mean, obviously the book has a lot of examples of exclusion. Mm-hmm. So maybe more of like how that's manifested in the Park Service, or like what they could do to address it.
One of the things I talk about in my book is this other book called The Green Book, which to me was an interesting, it was a travel guide that Black folk put together to a Black postman put together. And it was a tool that many Black people used to find out which places welcomed them, what places were accommodating to Black people. And so when you're on the road, you can look in the Green Book and see possible options that you wouldn't be excluded from because of segregation, that you could be welcomed in these places. And one of the special issues, I bring this up because one of the special issues of the Green Book, one issue was focused on the national parks. And it made me think, it had a listing of parks that had some, that Black folk had kind of highlighted as a space that some of the parks that were open to them that they felt comfortable after, you know. So in each year's, the Green Book listed different places. And so the national park issue highlighted those parks that had met that kind of standard. And I think it shows that people who have been excluded from places have a critique of those places, and they do list those places where they felt comfortable, and they recommend those places to others. And so I think in the case of Mammoth Cave, when the Branson family had that hotel that year, that park was listed in the Green Book as a place that was accommodating. So back even in the, like, I think it was like in the 1930s or something, that Brandon Hotel was listed in the Green Book. So Black folk had evaluated the various options before them and had said, well, this, you know, particular park makes the Green Book at a point in time. And so thinking about the history of the parks and looking at those times and periods where Black folk went and what they did at those parks, when they had accommodations or when they felt that the space was open to them. And that's one way to answer the question, is like looking into travel guides and things like that in which Black people themselves voted or through their contributions identify those places that were meeting their needs and they didn't feel discounted, at least in accommodations perhaps and access.
Yeah, I think one thing that people forget, I guess, is that to some extent that's still true today. So like, for example, you know, as a Black person or, you know, a LGBTQ person, mm-hmm. that you might mm-hmm. have to do some research before going somewhere about whether or not it's going to feel safe for you or be physically safe for you. And I think that's something that, you know, for example, like I didn't really realize growing up until, you know, I went to Spain in college, and that there was definitely like that Black people that were there definitely had different experiences as students there than I did. you know, which I mean, again, the education on all of this stuff is strong, but yeah, so all of that to say that we're at our next break point, and I'd like to continue this conversation once we come out of the break. So we'll be right back.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, we're back, and we were just talking about the Green Book, and I think it's kind of interesting because the Green Book, it's had kind of a moment lately where I feel like people are really interested in the Green Book, and, you know, like there was a movie about it, and I think it's interesting because, like, that's kind of a popular thing to interpret about segregation, if you will, right now. Mm-hmm. Then also in your book, you know, you're talking about how interpretation of things like segregation and slavery are really unpopular in the Park Service, that people, when they are interpreted, can have really negative reactions to it. Can you talk a little bit about that aspect?
Yeah, when I think about this idea, again, that I was proposing, this active exclusion, that means accountability on the part of institutions, particularly like places like the Park Service, in, right, you know, reconstituting how they, A, acquired their lands in the first place, and that scenario and formulation. And then, you know, what was the practice during periods like segregation and slavery, when some of these national park services were started or active. And so, you know, challenging that. And I think the Green Book, which was a travel guide that African Americans utilized a lot during segregation to navigate places like national parks or gas stations and restaurants, is a critique or is a way to turn a different lens onto and to interrogate places that were available to them. But I think in many cases that I've dealt with, the parks, even knowing that history, for example, Homestead Beach in Biscayne National Park down in here in South Florida, their visitor center sits on top of what was once a Black beach, a beach that was, you know, designated as the area Black people can swim at that national park site now. But there is no interp of that the fact that visitor center is sitting on that space that was formerly segregated and Black folk used it. There is no interpretation of that, although the park commissioned actually me and some of my students to collect some oral histories and things like that of people who used that as a Black beach at one point. But once they had the information, the park felt tension about using that because people didn't want to hear that kind of negative part of history for the park. So they don't really interpret it for fear of, right now, they told me, of disrupting, you know, people's sensibilities that use the park at this point. The primary audience of the park may not, you know, want to hear that kind of story and storytelling. So they, you know, about that situation. So they don't integrate, or they have not. I was shocked even a few years back I went, even after having that knowledge of the histories of the of folk who used the Black Beach and all that, they still didn't interpret it or had not yet done so. So that is a kind of a shocking kind of thing. And one of the things I interrogated about Kingsley Plantation, which is in Timucuaan National Park, is the fact that, you know, when they interpret the segregated period where they talk about the hotels and the activities available for people at their park site, they don't say that that was a white only space. They don't say that those hotels were totally excluding, you know, various different people, even as they glorify them as, you know, great sites of leisure on the park. And they don't indicate that that was for whites only and that there was a segregated areas of Timucuaan National Park. Yeah, you really have to, you know, dig through the history to find that kind of information. And I think parks need to be more forthcoming in those kinds of interpretation of what they were doing during these periods of segregation, only as a marker to show now, yes, the park is all inclusive perhaps, but they went through a period where no, that wasn't the case. And so that may be bring a more realistic picture to some of these sites and actually open up the space as a space of, you know, more people may be interested in, because A, you're learning the history, the robust history of the site. So I think by not talking about these kinds of stories, the park has misses a place to get different people interested and to educate people in different ways about the national parks and all of its, you know, complex history. And we should not shy away from that. And so I think in many of these sites, they are doing it because it puts you, the park, in a bad, you know, in a bad light in some mm-hmm. ways. But I think it also helps increase the some of the tensions around the questions that people are bringing up. I think if they knew the full history, they would ask these questions in a different way.
Well, and I mean, it ties back like you were just talking about right before the break about if basically you're saying to a community that your history is too uncomfortable for us to represent, then how can you expect them to want to come and have leisure at your park?
Yeah. And so, you know, a lot of ways the park can expand their story would actually be in more of these complex histories and representing these complex relations that they had with different communities. And that, I think that is something that people are going to have to make hard decisions about. Are you going to tell a comprehensive story of your park?
Yeah. And I mean, yeah. What do you value more? Do you value truth and making it a safe space, or do you value not making people feel uncomfortable? You know, like what you're sending a message, basically.
Right.
So this book, obviously we were talking about it before we started, we came officially on air, that, you know, you first sent this to me and I read it, I want to say, God, was that April, May? Which, of course, feels like a million years ago. We're recording this in December of 2020. And obviously the world is a little different than when this was published. Well, when you finished writing it, I'm sure even more. And then let's see, it was published. What's the published date? It just says 2020. Do you remember what month this was published in?
April 2020.
April. So. Yeah. So obviously, like when you sent in your final draft, there was no COVID. I mean, maybe it existed, but we certainly didn't know about it.
No. Yeah.
And obviously, you know, all of the racial injustice movement for this year, you know, the Black Lives Matter protests, the election. I mean, it's been a year. So if you had to, you know, if you could add to this book with this year in mind, what would you have to say? not to just drop a giant question.
I was gonna say, geez, wow. I don't know if I would have finished a book given if I was in the middle of COVID at this point, at that point, if the book wasn't finished. First of all, that would have been quite a challenge.
Yes.
Just because of the sheer distractions.
Yes. Well, yeah, let's start with COVID. How about that? I mean, obviously COVID, you know, it's shifted the way people think about where they can go and, you know, what is available to them and what their options are, you know, because I think for a lot of people, this is the first time they've really experienced not just being able to go wherever they want to go, whenever they want to go there, you know, like very much the concept of an American passport being like American Express, you know, that if you want to go there, you can go there. And then for the first time this year, you can't just leave the country necessarily, even if you want to. And even within the country, like you can't, like I can't go, you know, I don't know how many miles. It's not very far to New Mexico. Maybe 40 miles from where I live. But like in theory, right now, I can't go there unless I quarantine for 2 weeks.
Right. Exactly.
Right. Or just like even literally like, is it safe? Like you were talking about, is it safe to go to the grocery store? Is it safe to be out in public? Is it so that and then obviously the response to that, which has been pretty strong. And thinking about all of that in relation to your book where you're talking about, you know, very active exclusion of people from places. What parallels do you see between this movement or how has this movement been interesting for you? Sorry, not movement, moment, with all of that in mind.
Yeah. I think it brings that whole idea of sometimes when I'm listening to, you know, people talk about their restrictions and limitations and those things that they are faced with. I think it brings that notion, like you said, of active exclusion front and center for me in all of the ways that people were actively excluded from places of leisure, particularly as I'm discussing in this book, but from every aspect of living in terms of, you know, housing and education and those kinds of things. And I think people, a larger group of people, meaning mostly, you know, people who are considered white or are understanding unfortunate moment, what this notion of being actively unable to do certain things, like or being told that you can't go to a restaurant past a certain time or at any time, or like all these kinds of restrictions that are not typical in some communities. And whereas in my book, I'm talking about an era, a segment in history in which actively being excluded was a thing that an entire group of people had to navigate around. It was an institution around this exclusion. And then people had their own practices and they thought, had to think about other than themselves in terms of how do you coordinate together and get through something like this. And I think this is kind of, it could be a lesson in terms of how people who have not faced these kinds of conditions can look at the humanity that was within communities who, you know, have faced many of these conditions for longer periods of time and how, you know, the tools and the ways that people were able to not only showcase their own humanity, but be humane with one another and helpful for one another in order to survive, in order to live through these kinds of moments and still be have fellowship with one another. So I think if I was writing it highlighting it at this moment, I'm highlighting the fact that I think active exclusion, showing both sides of the picture, the sword, what it means when you can't do something, and what humanity exists or can exist and what kind of models can be put in place when you are subject to exclusions or not being able to do everything you want at the exact moment you want because of various strict conditions or and things like that. This is a different, totally different case with COVID, but I'm just saying the idea that people have felt these kinds of tensions before and in much more prolonged and rigorous undertakings. People have done it for over 100 years or so of this kind of condition. So, you know, how do you look to those places for lessons and maybe you relook at other communities and look at them in a different light? Maybe you're ready to have different kind of conversations now that more people have experienced these kinds of, you know, limits when limits are placed on you.
You know, so we had the start of COVID and people having that experience for the first time, reacting in many cases very badly to having that experience for the first time. And obviously the privilege that that highlights. And then immediately, well, really in the middle of all of that, there was a series of, you know, murders that caused protests across the country for the Black Lives Matter movement. So with all of the Black Lives Matter protests that happened this summer, did it make you think back on, I mean, obviously, first of all, how did it affect your work and any efforts that you and your university were working on in that regard? And second of all, did it make you think back about this book and have additional thoughts on any of the sections?
Yes, I think in every period, and particularly for me, every time I think I write, this is my second book, and the first book, a kind of crystallizing moment was when Michelle Obama came out that she was connected to one of the plantation communities that I had been, you know, working on up until the publication of the book, but I wasn't quite over the hurdle of it, of finishing the book. But when I heard about Michelle Obama's connection to the plantation, it gave me renewed energy and confidence around the topics and the things that were going to be covered in the book or that needed to be covered in the book. And so that was I call it a lightning bolt moment. So for this book, it's sort of a little bit after the fact, but I think they're every period a wake up call. And none of these issues are new since the inception of the U.S., obviously. Systemic racism, exclusion, some of the actual acquisition of lands, anyways, in the history of the U.S., it's all been problematic and has always remained so. But it goes under the surface, and then there are moments that punctuate that ease in which people are able to operate or either, you know, ignore those kinds of issues, except for if it's you know, affecting you, obviously you're very much in tune to all of the things that are going on. So I think with the George Floyd murder and some of the other unfortunate incidences of police brutality and those kinds of things, it was another punctuation, a wake up call to say, hey, U.S. and Western civilization in general, many of these issues have not been solved. We still have all of these institutional problems. We have still at the core and the base of many of these places are the same issues. And we really have to open it back up. Even COVID-19 has exposed the disparities in access and power and resources in different communities. So the Black Lives Matter movement have, again, highlighted that these are issues that are still with us. We have to open this back up, and which is what I do in the book, is open it back up, even through a benign, perhaps, or a conversation that seems easy. But if you look at the institutional practices around, you know, sites of leisure or places where people go to leisure, they're fraught with the same questions. They're fraught with the same institutional systems of racism that have not yet been addressed. And we keep asking the same old questions of like, why, when we really probably need to be, again, examining the construction of some of these institutions from the ground up. And I think this moment, the BLM moment and Black Lives Matter movement moment, COVID-19, I think will be more people moving toward what I kind of talk about in that act of exclusion, kind of applying that frame to how you tackle some of these questions. And I think that at this moment of the book speaks to you know, the moment, it's kind of a validation that this is a moment that this idea of being excluding somebody at an institutional level, and how do you see those institutional triggers is what my book talks about. I think that, you know, it is a validation in that sense, and in a exposure. And I think we're going to continue to be exposed to this unless we really get into these systems and really start interrogating how they have been put together and how you keep repeating the same old processes if you don't really take them apart.
So, okay. I mean, at this point, we're what, 10 months out from the murder of Ahmaud Arbery, 6 months from George Floyd, I think. Breonna Taylor was, what, a little bit earlier than that. Do you feel like, you know, being this many months out, obviously we saw a lot of efforts and change in the months immediately afterwards. Are you hopeful that those efforts are going to keep going, or are you concerned that this will be another kind of blip and then people will kind of get comfortable again and go back to the way it was?
For me, I think I'm optimistic. I'm not. I think this moment has opened up such a wound, and so many people are now visibly impacted and are at whatever moment, it's a critical mass of people actually seeing the same thing, the same disruption in the same way, that this is a problem. And that I think we are at a moment of possible, that it's possible to make some significant changes. And I see it in the university in some sense, and a lot of these institutions, where the first step, of course, at least is acknowledging through many of these statements that people have been making about their support for the Black Lives Matter movement, or other issues of support, like these the prevalence of land acknowledgement statements now. I think these at least as one step. And I tell in my department and things, I say that you know, we have these statements. If we're putting them up on our site, then we actually have to start to do the work, the processes to make it meaningful. The statement is one thing, but we need to take those down if we aren't really going to engage in the steps, in the hard steps and the prolonged steps of making sure that we, you know, just change some of the processes in which is a reason for these statements being up there in the first place. You know, our institutions have excluded many Black people from ranks of different ranks within the professorship and management and administration. Why is that? Why are those disparities there? And what can we do within our department to, or within your sphere that you're operating in, to counter some of that? And I think people have the energy right now around doing it. It's discouraging because there's so many, like a boat with a lot of different holes in it. And then you plug one and you find out it's like 20 leaks over somewhere else. And I think, you know, I'm concerned about fatigue is more than anything. I think, you know, people start out with a lot of energy around it. And this is only, like you said, we're only in December. And this is like only 6, 7, 8 months into a lot of, this is going to take way more than 6 months or even a year or two. Like, if you're invested in this, it's going to take a lot of action. And I'm concerned about the stamina. I'm really optimistic about people seeing what concretely and clearly, more clearly, what's going on, and more people being open to speaking out. Like, people are pointing out things. And I think that even though there's more protests and pushback because of, you know, some of the administration at the governmental levels, at the highest governmental levels, but I think people are empowered to talk and speak out too, and point out the problems and fight back. So I think people aren't going to silence the issue as easily as they have in the past. I think people are not going to be silenced around this. So it's going to be a continuous push. But I am concerned about stamina for people who aren't used to the fight. Like, some of us, stamina is not the issue, because it is, and you have to keep moving and keep pushing. But I'm concerned about the stamina of people who maybe have the luxury of sometimes, like, you know, sitting it out.
Right.
And like on the sidelines and being okay, you know, with those periods of time when you can sit it out. But that's not going to help us at this point. We all need to be tired, get a little rest and keep going, because this is a long fight. And we have done a lot of, you know, given where we are right now in the country, I think a lot of momentum has started.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today and having these really important conversations with us.
Yeah, thank you, Jessica. And, you know, hang in there. I know all of communities everywhere under pressures, and we're all tired. And I understand tiredness. And I just want to tell people, we, you know, to stay encouraged. And there are so many good examples out there of people who have pushed through and how they've pushed through. So let's keep it up.
All right. And the book, again, it's Heritage, Tourism, and Race, The Other Side of Leisure by Dr. Antoinette Jackson. It's available through the Routledge Press, and we'll have a link to it in our show notes.
Great. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/Heritage Voices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Music Store. Also, if you like the show, please share with your friends or write us a review. If you have any questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org, or you can find me on Facebook through Living Heritage Anthropology or on Twitter @LivingHeritageA. As always, thank you to Lyle Blanqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.